you for the introduction, and I'm very grateful that Lucia and Mark introduced many body theory this morning so nicely. That saves me a lot of time. And instead, I can touch upon two examples that we've explored recently, where I think these many body effects really matter, and not only help us understand things, but give us a quantitative description of the system. And they're given here in the title. So one is the what is known as the CO adsorption puzzle. And it was found in the early 2000s that CO adsorbed on several metal surfaces. Experimentally, it's found on the top side, but density functional theory and the local density or gradient corrected approximation predicts it to be stable in the hollow side here. And this energy is not small. So it gets it wrong by 0.5 electron volts. This is the largest case on copper. And this is already an energy difference of an energy difference, where you would expect error cancellation to come into play and help you. But here, it doesn't seem to be the case. So I'll come back to this in the second part of the talk. The other example that I picked is the oxygen vacancy in magnesium oxide. There's many different names. It's called the F center or the color center. And it's probably the classic F center in a compound insulator. That makes it interesting. It's been studied for a long time, 5 decades, maybe even longer. What is so puzzling about it is, and that actually made it very hard at the beginning to figure out what was going on, is that the F center and the F plus, so when it has one electron less in the center, absorb at nearly the same energy. So these are the two spectra here measured in the 70s, but many different groups. It goes to the 90s. And the picture is always the same. These lines are virtually indistinguishable. That's one feature. And if you look at the scale down here, you notice that the peak is very, very broad. Yeah, I mean, a half width of 0.5 to 0.7 electron volts. And this has not been reproduced by theory yet. There have actually been some multi-reference CI calculations for clusters. And I think they get this energy difference roughly right, but the adsorption energy is 6 electron volts. So they overshoot by 1 electron volt, right? So magnesium is actually a very simple material. That's why we like it as theoreticians. So the structure couldn't be more simpler. It's a wide gap insulator. It's light elements. That's usually good for our theories. If you're using pseudopotentials, for instance, but the electron-phonon coupling is very strong, and that'll play a large role here. I'll come back to that later. And it's very ubiquitous, right? It's applied in medicine as a relief of heartburn, you know, anti-acid, short-term laxative, in libraries, believe it or not, as a moisture reductor, and in construction, fireproofing, and then in electronics, of course. In catalysis, it plays a huge role as support. And it's believed to be very active when lithium doped. In electronics, that's not even microelectronics, it's used to insulate cables, and then in microelectronics to alloy with zinc oxide, for instance, to tune the band gap. And in spintronics as a tunnel barrier. So how would you approach this problem? Oh, first, let me introduce the notation that I'm using here. So the removal of an oxygen atom here gives you one clear level in the band gap that can be filled by 2 electrons. That's then known as the F center. If you remove one, we have the F plus center. We get a lattice distortion here. The atoms move outwards. And then we can remove the other electron too. That gives us the F2 plus center. So how would you approach this problem in density functional theory? Well, you would take LDA, and then you do ground state calculations first. You relax, you get the structures that I've shown you. And then you can do this for the different ground state geometries. And then you can, for every geometry, change the charge state. So that gives you some kind of 3x3 matrix of energies. And then you can say, OK, I just look at the difference information energies. So from the F center, I can imagine an optical excitation to be such that I remove an electron, and I put it in the conduction band. And that's this energy here. And you see it's 3 electron volts and not 5. Yeah. And then this other one is 4.1 and not 4.95. So not only are we off by quite a bit, we get the order wrong. Yeah. You may say, okay, LDA may not be the best functional. So we did this with HSE. We had a mixing parameter of 0.35. I know it's not 0.25. And that gives us a band gap of 7.3. You see the F center, if you'd stopped there, you would have probably said, okay, that gives us gratifying agreement. But then when you do the F plus center, we overshoot massively again, and again, the order is wrong. Yeah. So we like to use the theory like GW, because you know it gives us good band gaps. We believe that the transition energies are good. But so these were total energies, right? And there's a discrepancy here. So what we did together with, or based on an idea developed by Martin Tedstrom and Arno Schindelmeier, was we build a correction scheme for these formation energies. It's a busy slide here. So let's start with the formation of a positive vacancy, for instance. So this would be a total energy difference of that structure minus a reference system. And then we can just add zeros, basically. So if we pick the right total energy here, in this case, it's in the same charge state but a different structure. And then we subtract it and add it. We haven't changed anything, but we can regroup terms then. So if we keep the charge state the same, this is just a relaxation energy. Yeah? And then we add and subtract again a suitably chosen total energy. And then we see by keeping the structure fixed now and changing the charge state, we get an affinity. Yeah? So all together, we can rewrite, and this is still exact, the formation of a positively charged defect as the formation of a 2+ defect, the addition of an electron and a subsequent relaxation energy. So that's shown schematically here. Right? We add an electron, let things relax. And then we can do the same thing for the neutral. We add another electron and let things relax. So now we have decomposed this, and we can then pick the most suitable method for every quantity that we have created. And we know affinities, they're given well by GW. So we pick GW there. Relaxation energies in the same charge state we believe to be reasonably accurate in DFT. So we keep LDA, and then for the 2+, where there are no electrons in the defect, we believe that the LDA doesn't do too bad a job either. Actually, for silicon, we found that if you do this for the silicon self-interstitial, this neutral state or the correction to that can be as large as 1.1 electron volts. So it's not small. So just briefly about GW, we've done a lot of calculations for several solids. What is shown here is the band gap is what Mark showed earlier today, the same kind of plot. Calculated band gap versus experimental band gap for a collection of semiconductors. You see LDA heavily underestimates. And then we based our GW calculations on not LDA, but exact exchange. This is OEP exact exchange. You can see OEP exact exchange does fairly well, but it doesn't get it all the way. And then we have to include the GW to get that. This not only works for the gaps, it also works for the for other K points. This is angle resolved photo emission data from a Japanese group for zinc oxide in black, blue, and white. And superimposed, this is just for the valence bands, is the GW band structure that we calculated. It's again based on exact exchange, and you can see it's really in remarkable agreement all across the band zone. So then the question is, well, for magnesium oxide, what should we aim for? What is the band gap of magnesium oxide? Any opinion? 7.8. This goes a long time back in the 70s. It was all optical absorption. But then what about electron-phonon coupling? Well, we looked at this, and there's a way to calculate this. You can take the, like in GW, the electron-electron self-energy, there's an electron-phonon self-energy, right? So for a given electron or hold state NK, as a function of energy or temperature, you can write this down, and this is the equivalent of G times the phonon propagator instead of G times W. And what you need as ingredients are the electron or hole occupation factors and the phonon occupation factors, and then their respective energies, then you have an absorption and emission term, and then you need the coupling elements here, the electron-phonon coupling elements there. And if you do this separately for the electrons in the holes, you will get a renormalization of the band gap from this expression. So that's what we did using just simple LDA for the phonons and the electron-phonon coupling matrix elements. The quantum espresso code can do it in density function perturbation theory, and Habener can do it too. And then the band structure we took from GW, Rex's space-time code, and the band gap renormalization is huge. It's 0.3 electron volts. This is a lower bound, it's probably higher, and we made some approximations. And this is at zero Kelvin due to zero-point vibrations. Right? In experiment, you cannot switch it off. Right? In other words, if you have a zero-temperature theory, like GW at present, you should not be aiming for 7.8. Right? You should be aiming for 8.1 or 8.3. So here's a collection of band gaps that we have calculated. The structure of the plot is such that this gives you the DFT functional and then the DFT band gap. And then in blue, you see the G naught, W naught gap that we got by using this as a starting point. So you see, if you do LDA, you underestimate, and LDA plus GW also gives you a much lower gap of just 7. Now, if we do this exact exchange again, we get closer, and exact exchange plus GW gets us to 8.1. So we're just touching on where we believe the to be without electron-phonon coupling or renormalization. My problem was I couldn't do an exact exchange calculation for the defang, so I had to play some trickery. And what I did was I constructed a sort of modified PB0 calculation. And I'll show you in a second what this is. And then, if I base GW on that, I essentially reproduce the exact exchange-based GW calculations for bulk magnesium oxide, so I believe this to be, in this particular case, a good sort of side cut. So the defect calculations we did in LDA for all the structures, pseudopotential program, 64 atom supercells. For the charge cells, we used a new correction scheme developed by Christoph Freisold, Jürgen Neugebauer, and Chris van der Waal. The GW calculations were done for the same structures. With a space-time code, we can go up to 64 atom cells for these light elements. This is all a single processor. And convergence parameters. So the modified PB0 is basically I took an LDA calculation and then applied perturbatively, so I kept the wave functions the same. This operator took 25% Hartree-Fock and then 75% exchange correlation from LDA. So this is then the formation energy diagram, or configuration diagram that you get. GW corrected with this scheme that we have developed. You see it has the same structure, you wouldn't expect it any different, but now these transition energies are significantly larger, yeah? And they're actually in the same ballpark now, 5.4, 5.5. You see those were the values we got, the LDA and HSE. Now we're too large, right? So at least 400 MeV too large compared to experiment. But remember, this was for an ionization process. This pointer is dying. So the electron is in the conduction band, has been removed from the defect. But what you do in optical absorption is you create electron hole pairs. So the exciton binding energy is still missing from this picture here. So we did calculate that too. Andre Schleifer did it with the WASP code. We used the same geometries, again, 64 atom supercells. We had to use a model dielectric function. I don't think it's crucial here. We also had to use hybrid K-point meshes and then really extrapolate to the infinite K-point limit to extract reliable exciton binding energies. And you see that, again, very large. Yeah, so 0.5 to 0.7 electron volts. And then we have to subtract these exciton binding energies from the quasi-particle excitation. And if we do that, we get the following what we believe are the optical transition energies. And they're now in very good agreement with experiment. We A, get the order right, so the F plus has a lower transition energy, and the values agree fairly well too. So then there's one more question, and it has to do with the vibrational contributions for this effect now. If electron-phonon coupling is large, then it probably has an effect on this too. It's a very schematic picture. We do the excitation from the ground state here to the excited state, and then the system can relax, can vibrate with this frequency here, and this relaxation energy is actually enumerated by this Huang-Ries factor here that counts it in terms of the vibrational quanta. So then if there are no vibrational excitations, we get the zero phonon line here, and the difference between the zero phonon line and the direct excitation is actually just this value here. So what is usually then done is to make the following approximation. You say, okay, the curvature in both excited and ground state is the same, and we have no vibrational excitation in the ground state, and then we can basically solve this analytically if you know the curvature and this transition energy or relaxation energy here, and then you can calculate the vibrational broadening of your optical signal. And that's what we did. So we did, in this case, a constrained LDA calculation. So I promote an electron from the defect into the conduction band, and I let the system relax in LDA. And then from this, I can extract the curvature and this relaxation energy here. And you see the vibrational frequency of this for the F and the F plus center is in very good agreement with what has been measured in the 90s. And then this Huang-Ries factor that we extract, that is actually a lot smaller. Now, I believe that there's something more going on in the experiment. You remember, this width was huge. So I believe there are actually more than one vibrational excited levels in the ground state. In addition, we already see that this curvature is not the same. So this very, very simple analysis is probably not valid here. But we kept it at this for now. So if you put everything together, oh, one more thing. So if you do this, if you make these simplifying approximations, the vibrations don't change your transition energies. They just give you broadening. Yeah. So the E0 that we calculated before, that is where our peak maximum will be. So if we add the vibrational broadening, then we get the black lines, and that compares very favorably to the experimental optical spectra. You can see they're actually a lot broader, and the peaks are asymmetric, so we can take this to higher levels of analysis. But we believe, I mean, so far, this is the best agreement that's ever been reported for this F center. Good, so this was one way of calculating these formation energy differences. Now, it would actually be nice if we could somehow incorporate this machinery into calculating total energies directly, and then we can compare really many body total energies and subtract them. And that is what we did for this COS puzzle. And we tackled this with RPA. And RPA is really sort of the consistent theory to GW. Or GW self-energy. So in a nutshell, what is it? We can use the principle of adiabatic connection to define the exact exchange correlation energy, which is given by this coupling constant integration of this quantity here. And this you can get from the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And you can write it down exactly like this, where you need to know the exact response function. Now here comes the approximation. So we know that this fulfills a Dyson equation. So it's given in terms of the non-interacting response function, and then this kernel here with the Coulomb potential, and the exchange correlation kernel. So if we set this to zero, yeah, turns out that we can do this coupling constant integration analytically, and then we get the random phase approximation for this. And the total energy, or the exchange correlation energy in RPA, is then the exact exchange energy plus the RPA correlation energy, and it's given by this expression here. And once you have a GW code, you essentially have this quantity, because we always calculate a polarizability first to get to W, to get to the self-energy. So that's what we did. This is a different code now. I'm not going to say much about it. It's called FHI Ames. It's an all-electron numeric atom-centered orbital code that was developed at the Fritz Haber in the last few years. There's a poster by Volker Blum if you want more details. Here are the references for the Ames code and then our test results for the RPM. Just a few, in case you're not familiar with the RPA as such, attractive features about it. I said it has the exact exchange. You have to be slightly careful. This is done perturbatively in most cases. So this will be exact exchange with the Cohn-Sham orbitals, right? So if we do an LDA calculation first, like the Langquist-Lundquist function, we apply it just as a one step afterwards, post-processing, then we feed in the LDA orbitals into this expression here. And this does appreciably reduce the self-interaction error. And there's correlation part here that gives us van der Waals interactions automatically and seamlessly. So we don't have to make any approximations or any assumptions about the system. And it includes screening, unlike MP2, for instance. Right? And therefore, it's applicable to metals and small gap systems, unlike MP2. And there are a lot of groups that are now implementing this or have implemented this. There's been a flurry of papers. I didn't cite them all here. So I believe that a critical assessment of this is now emerging, and we're going to see a lot more in the future. So we're talking about carbon oxide on copper. So let's first look at CO itself. And there can't be a talk on a small molecule without a gigantic table. So what I collected here are several quantities, the binding energy, the equilibrium bond distance, the vibrational frequency, the hormone, the Luma energy, calculated in various approximations compared to experiment down here. So in blue is all the RPA or the GW, and red is the DFT. And in green, I denoted those values that agree best with the experimental numbers. And you can see that with the exception of these two, it's always GW RPA applied on top of a PbE0 calculation. LDA, you know, gets this equilibrium distance about right, and then PbE0 is best for the binding energies. But then on the DFT side, it's really mix and match. You know, you for every quantity, you have the best functional, right? On the RPA GW side, this is not the case. So here, we see a systematic improvement going from LDA as a starting point to PbE to PbE0 as a starting point. So we do have the starting point dependence, but you can argue that for at least these molecular systems, PbE0 is actually closer to the final answer, and therefore we should use that. You can see here for the, and this I think goes back to a question we had earlier, does something like GW work for a finite system? I mean, you can't get much smaller than CO. And you see here the screen Coulomb interaction that we have in the theory doesn't do too badly. Right? So then when we put it on the copper, we don't treat the extended system as such. In the RPA, what we use is a cluster correction. So this is a local XC correction scheme that was developed at the Fritz Haber. So we look at the difference between a high-level exchange correlation functional and PBE for the same cluster. Yeah, so here, examples that we considered. And then we take the limit to the infinite cluster size limit for this correction here. And you can see this is shown here for different functionals, for the top side and the hollow side, that this correction, this difference here, actually converges quite well with respect to cluster size. The individual components here, they wouldn't. You can see this long decay. You can also see that, so this the zero would be the PBE, and you can see that the AMO5 functional actually corrects in the wrong direction here. Yeah, so it would increase the binding, and then HSE and PBE0 give you correction in the right direction, and then RPA, it's even stronger. So this is for the two sides separately, but what we're interested in is the difference between the two. So then we can define an adsorption energy for the compound system by doing this in PVE, for instance. This has really been done for an extended system. And then we add this extrapolated correction of the different functionals to it to get an adsorption energy. And you can see that this goes down systematically for both sides as you go from AMO5 to PVE to PVE0 to RPA. So these adsorption energies decrease. And if you look at the difference, this is shown in this plot here. So this dashed line would be the limit where the top side becomes stable over the hollow side. So you want to be above this line where you're functional. You can see PVE doesn't do it, AMO5 doesn't do it. PVE0 and HSE are virtually indistinguishable, and they give you sort of a marginal side preference. And if you want a better side preference, you have to go to RPA. And then to put numbers to this, we compared with what was available in the literature. This is our work. There was previous work. So we can see, so these PVE and PVE0 results, they were actually done for extended systems. And if you compare to our extrapolated ones for PVE and PVE0, you see that this cluster correction approach works remarkably well in very good agreement with the extended calculations. And you see here that our RPA binding energy, so also for the top side, in very good agreement with the available experimental data and with high-level quantum chemical calculations. And for the FCC side, there's no experimental data available so far. So the comparison there is more difficult. So then finally, my last slide. I like to bring this back to the spectrum. So we had the RPA correlation energy, and then the associated self-energy to this, if you want to do spectroscopy, is the GW self-energy. So here we've done calculations with GW, PBE, and PB0 for CO on a copper 16 cluster. So this is 3CO. Here are the levels. You see that, again, GW gives the best agreement with the experimental values. And then as you put the CO on on copper, you see two things. The levels shift and they broaden. Yeah? And that is what Angel talked about on Monday, that you get this renormalization due to image effects and all sorts of things. We actually did this for CO and sodium chloride on germanium with GW. If you're interested in that, you see the same effect. So this is important because the bonding mechanism is one of donation, back donation, right? And you see that PBE predicts the wrong homo and lumo positions for CO on copper. Therefore, it would accept too much, or it would have the wrong back donation, back donation charges. Right? And then GW, this is appreciably lower. So this homo position is crucial here. On the copper side, so these were the CO orbitals projected, and then the copper orbitals don't actually change that much in the various theories. So finally, instead of a conclusion, I like to give an outlook. So there are many things we want to do in addition to what I just shown you. So it would be very nice if we could do the RPA also for defects, for instance. And we're working towards it, but you need to be able to do 64 atoms or even more. You know, sometimes those cells are still too small. So we need efficient algorithms for this. You've seen the starting point dependence. Mark introduced a very nice scheme. It'd be good if we could do something like this also for the RPA. Then I'm sure that the field will find that RPA works fine in some cases, and there'll be a lot of cases where it doesn't. So we can probably already start thinking about how we will eventually go beyond the RPA. For CO on copper, the vibrational effects weren't too important, but for magnesium oxide, you saw that you really need to think about phonons too. So it'd be very nice. So at the moment we pieced it together, that was the best we could do. But it would be very nice to have a consistent framework for electrons, electron holes, and electron phonon coupling, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So finally, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. So the defect work we did here at Santa Barbara to together with Anderson Giannotti and Chris Vandervalle and Matthias Scheffler. Andre Schleifer did the BSE calculations, and Friedhelm Bechstedt's group, and Christoph Freisel contributed various parts to it too on the DFT side. The electron-phonon coupling was done by Manos Kiopakis and Chris Vandervalle too. And the RPA we did in Berlin is mostly Xingu Ren's work, together with Matthias and Volker Blum, the main author of the code. And this wouldn't be possible without the whole AIMS developer team. Funding came from NanoQuanta and the European Theoretical Spectroscopy Facility, the German Science Foundation that paid me, and NSF Mersenne. And if you're interested, here are some papers that talk about this. And thank you for your attention.
That was a very nice talk, Patrick. I had a question about the RPA total energy. It's been tried by a few groups, and it's known that it's very, very difficult to converge with respect to unoccupied states. So I just wondered if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think the convergence is as slow as it is in GW. We spent quite some time converging it, and I think we're down to something like 50 millielectron volts on the binding energies, or on the absorption energies. Yeah. But yeah, we did look at this systematically. Yeah, I mean, this is not plane waves anymore, so you'll find that to converge an LDA absorption energy or total energy, you need far smaller basis sets than you do for RPA or GW.
Actually, sorry, just a quick comment on that. As we were discussing before, we have implemented the calculation of dielectric matrices without empty states, and we have done solution of the Stern-Neimer equation, and we have compared with calculation, EXX RPA calculation for certain system done just by converging as a function of excited states, and indeed it is quite difficult. It's very, very difficult to converge as a function of excited states and also as a function of basis set. Sorry, I took your time.
I just have a comment here. It's pretty well known that the correlation energies of the RPA is about a factor of two too large in all systems. For some funny reason that at least I don't understand, and I don't know if anybody else understands, the binding energy seems to be in much better shape. But on the other hand, if you include exchange correlation effects beyond RPA, then it turns out that the if you do that or just include the exchange effects beyond RPA, then you will find that the total energies are extremely accurate. And I would guess then also, of course, binding energies are also extremely accurate. So that's something you could try.
Right, that makes it a bit harder to compare with experiment. So you need...
Why would it be hard to compare with experiment?
Well, because they usually measure total energy differences.
Right, but I mean, that's what you can calculate.
Sure, but they're already okay, as you said.
Oh, okay, okay.
So you need, you need high-level quantum Monte Carlo or Kappa cluster.
Yeah. Do you have a reply? Go ahead.
Yeah, okay, you calculated the excitons at the defect using a model dielectric function, you said?
Yeah, Bechstedt's infamous model.
Okay, so it's a model dielectric function for the defect-free system. Is this correct?
Andre?
I can't hear you very well, but it... Yes, okay. Yeah. So you think that the screening... it's correct for the exciton at the defect to take a screening that has not the defect inside. Is this... is it because you think that the exciton is so weakly bound that you see a sort of average screening, or is it so tightly bound that you don't see screening anymore?
It is very tightly bound.
Mm-hmm.
And I would expect anything beyond the model to be a secondary effect.
Because you are heading for a difference of 50 millielectron volt, right, between the two color centers. So very small difference experimentally,
yeah, that's right.
And also, if you think that you could take the bulk dielectric function, then you could also calculate it ab initio, right? You could calculate it in the small cell and then use it to screen your supercell, if you think that this is a good approximation.
Yeah, I guess we could try it. To capture the relaxation, the 64 atoms are sort of borderline. So you'd have to, if you constructed a smaller cell, you'd have to make sure that the geometry of that small cell mimics that of the larger cell very closely, because the atomic motion affects the energies very strongly.
Yeah, but I mean, if you take a model dielectric screening of the ideal cell, you could do the same ab initio, if you really think that the defect doesn't influence screening.
So you're saying that we should use a smaller cell and do it fully ab initio?
You could. I was just wondering how much you think the screening business would influence the exciton, right?
Right.
Yeah. I know. It's possible.
I just have a question. So, do you do RPA calculation self-consistently?
No.
So, we did a calculation and we found that there's a geometry effect on this absorption energy. If this, that is consistently too big, then the absorption energy will be larger, I think. And also, we did a meta-TGA calculation. Our results, I think, very close to experiment data. And the site preference is almost degenerate for platinum. For platinum.
That's using what, a meta-TGA?
Yeah, meta-TGA, Rift PS.
Yeah, that's possible. So, we did this at the, did we do it at the experimental lattice console? I forgot to point this out actually. For CO, just the bare molecule, we saw quite a significant appreciable starting point dependence. For this combined system now, CO on copper. We did it with all the three functionals too, and the difference is marginal here. So you see 20 milliEV in the absorption energy. So there, I wouldn't really expect self-consistency to play any role. So I believe that what we have as a description here is already the RPA final.
The lattice constant is you use RPA.
We did not optimize the lattice constant of copper in RPA. Yet, I think we're working towards that. D.L. Kresse did this with the VASP code, and he found that lattice constants and RPA came out to be very, very well. So there's every reason to expect that it will be close to the. I don't know if we included copper in the PRL that came out. But, so I think it's a safe bet to use the experimental lattice constant here.
Okay, Patrick. Okay, one comment, respect. To Lucia's question, because Michael did this test of the dielectric response using the dielectric response of the defect system and the dielectric response of the bulk. The effect is negligible.
I only tested
for different systems, for silicon carbide and for XM, there's another system.
Strongly bound.
Okay. I only tested it for GW.
We did it on nitride, which is strongly bound. It's even strongly bound than here, it's 1.5
EV. The general message would be, if we have a strongly bound defect for the calculation of the screen, we can forget the defect.
Exactly.
That's great.
For the screen, if you are looking to the screen, if you are looking to luminescence, it's not. The question, might not be too general. My question was related to the electron-phonon coupling, that you got this big effect due to the zero-point renormalization, which is for magnesium oxide.
Right.
Do you think there is a link between this effect and the fact that you have a wide band gap insulator, and this effect will get smaller and smaller as you reduce the gap? Because if not, if that's the case and it's important, basically we have to revisit all the previous calculations in which we got good agreement.
Right. I don't think it's related to the gap at all. It's related to the type of atom. So it'd be light elements, oxygen, nitrogen, magnesium, lithium, that kind of stuff. So wherever you have no shielding from the core, essentially. Right. So first row.
Okay, one more quick geometry question. One of the things you complained about, and rightly so, is that if you're trying to do semi-local DFT, you need different functionals for different properties. And one of those is lattice parameters. So in your color center work, you used exact exchange and semi-local correlation as your starting point for your GW. Were you also able to use that for the lattice parameters and for the phonon properties? Or because I would think that it would not work particularly well.
What would not work?
That's exact exchange, semi-local correlation does not do a good job of predicting lattice parameters and probably would not do a good job of predicting the stuff you need for phonon effects. Is that true or?
Right. Altogether, I don't think there's enough data for a conclusive answer. So we did all the defect calculations at the LDA lattice constant and the LDA geometries. When I showed the band gap comparison, that was at the, for bulk magnesium oxide, that was at the experimental lattice parameters. Now for phonon calculations, I don't know. Yeah. So I think that, I don't know if anybody in the room knows how well, say, PBE0 would do, or I don't think it's really been done with the local exact exchange functionality, OEP. I don't think there are any systematic studies on how well that would do for phonon properties.
Okay, but you did need to use a couple different functionals in this work because of all these unfortunate deficiencies that they have.
Essentially, yes. I mean, we had to piece it together. Yeah.
Well done. Kieran first, and then Mark.
Thanks. I'd like to get back to this RPA, the RPA results. There's a couple of things that we know which may be relevant both to the general question of having double the energy but not, but the binding energy is coming out, double the correlation energy, but the binding energy is coming out, and also with the convergence issue. You can show that straight RPA gives you a universal condition on the derivative of the pair correlation function at zero separation. You can show that there's a universal cusp condition, which is incorrect, but it is universal within RPA. And this has a couple of consequences. Now the on-top pair correlation function, of course, doesn't contribute a whole lot to the actual energy, but it does determine the shape of things that follow as you move away. And so the fact that it's universal suggests that, and it also is correct in the high density limit, but nowhere else. But then if it's a universal feature, if you subtract two energies, you'll make the same mistake in both of them in a certain way. But also Philip Firsch has shown that because of this sort of bad cusp condition, this may be strongly related to the difficulty with the convergence. I don't know. I mean, people in wave function theory think that. And also, if you add in any kind of TD-DFT to put in an exchange correlation kernel like ALDA, in a localized basis set, the energy is barely converged at all in the sense that if you say it converges so slowly with basis set that it's almost irrelevant as a practical matter to say that it does converge. And this is, again, due to the small distance behavior of the kernel. And also suggest that if you round it off, that maybe your convergence problem will go away and it won't affect the energies.
How would you round it off?
Well, you know, make it smoother.
Just a small comment on the electron phonon. So Manuel Cardona has a paper where he tabulates it for godzillion materials, including magnesium oxide, and there it was 0.3 EV, so congratulations, Patrick. In the QSUW data I presented, all of that was taken into account, and you have to, at that level of precision, if you want to agree that well, you have to take into account this effect. It's small for heavy elements like 0.1 EV, for diamond it's 0.5 EV, so for light elements it matters, for heavy elements it doesn't matter so much. Yeah, you. That's right. Because of the quantum effects, it has a zero slope, so you have to extrapolate the linear part to zero temperature. Yes.
So you took it into account in the experimental values, not in the theory.
Okay. So I think we will declare that we are not too hungry and take another question.
Could take a long time, I'm afraid. So I've also done some calculations just in density functional theory on formation energies of charge defects. And I know that dealing with the interactions between charge defects in neighboring supercells is incredibly hard to get right. Could you just say a little bit about how you do that?
Right. So this was really not my scheme. It was developed by, I think Chris just left, so he can't back me up on this. So what Christoph did was basically he realized that you needed to take into account the screening of the medium around it, right? So you build a theory where he models the long-range part of this point charge, right? And then that is subtracted to give you a short-range part that is left. And that is such that it does not extend beyond the supercell, and then you can treat that in a different way.
Do you treat the elastic and Coulomb effects together?
No, there's no correction on the elastic effects.
Because our experience was that is bad, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, for magnesium oxide, it was okay, but for other materials where the ionic response is very strong, the ionic response to charge is very strong, this scheme becomes questionable, I think.
Okay, let me thank all.